Feeling stuck by a tough life decision? Wondering how to navigate career and leadership changes without chaos? Welcome to Problem Solved, the podcast where we cut through the confusion and turn uncertainty into action. I'm your host, Cheryl Strauss Einhorn, and I'm here to empower you with a powerful tool, the AREA Method. Forget overwhelm, forget endless Googling, get ready to make confident, well-researched decisions that take charge of your life. Whether it's finding the perfect college, the ideal career path, or the best care for your loved ones. This isn't just about theory. Here we'll tackle real-world scenarios, dive into inspiring stories, and equip you with actionable steps. So buckle up, listeners, because it's time to say goodbye to indecision and hello to solutions. I'm thrilled to have Charles Hecker with us today. He is the author of a brand new book about Russia called Zero Sum, The Arc of International Business in Russia. Charles has spent 40 years traveling and working in the Soviet Union and Russia. He's worked as a journalist at the Miami Herald and the Moscow Times, and as a geopolitical risk consultant at Control Risks, where he was a partner in the firm. He's a regular contributor to Monocle Radio and has offered expert commentary on Times Radio, the BBC, and so many more. He is fluent in Russian, and he currently resides in East London. Charles, we are thrilled to have you here today. Welcome to the Problem Solve podcast.
Cheryl, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you. So I'm very excited about our discussion today. We always start with the same question. Why is problem solving important?
Cheryl, we are living in an incredibly volatile world, whether it's politically, geopolitically, economically, even socially and culturally. We have left our comfort zone. The way that we lived and the environment that we lived in over the past decades, really, I mean, five, six, seven decades, are really receding fairly rapidly in the past. And there's an enormous amount of pressure on people and on companies and organizations, not only to solve problems, but to solve new problems. And we're having to feel our way through this without a whole lot of spare time and without the luxury of contemplation. We're getting political problems thrown at us, geopolitical problems, environmental problems, social problems, economic problems that we've never confronted before. And, you know, they're interacting globally in a way that they never interacted before. And so our skills as problem solvers, identifying problems in the first place, unpicking them, and then trying to diffuse them in an efficient and comprehensive manner is getting harder and harder and harder, and we've got less and less time to get it right. So problem solving now is absolutely paramount.
Thank you for that. I completely agree. It seems like the world is getting faster. It seems like the problems are coming at us with greater complications. And so really knowing problem solving skills is so important. So let's turn to your book. Give us a little bit of background about you and why you wanted to write Zero Sum.
Thanks, Cheryl. I mean, the background about me, the potted version, is that I'm a Russia geek. And, you know, I did some undergraduate studies and graduate studies in Soviet studies, which tells you a little bit about how old I am. And then after a brief stint in journalism in the United States, I went and I became a journalist for the Moscow Times in Russia. And that is an English language newspaper. I went there in 1994. The Moscow Times is still thriving. It's in exile now, out of Russia, but it's still going great guns. And I worked in the mid-1990s for the Moscow Times and then decided it was time for a change from journalism. And I went into the consulting business. And I went to work for a firm called Control Risks. And that is a London-based but global specialist risk consultancy. And for almost all of my 25-year career there, which has come to a very successful and pleasant end, with the publication of my book, I was involved in the company's Russia business. I was the managing partner of the Moscow office for about 8 years. And then I was the co-director with a colleague of our global geopolitical risk practice. And then I took a sabbatical to write the book. I enjoyed writing the book. And when sabbatical was over, I did not go back.
Okay. All right. So tell us a little bit about the story. It really is an unbelievable story, and yet it's true. So what makes it a story of capitalism in Russia that is unique?
So I think the idea to write the book sort of fell on my head when I was going for a walk through the park near where I live in East London. And it also had to do with what I was doing at work at the time before I started writing the book. But, you know, Cheryl, I think all good books and all good stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And suddenly the story of capitalism in Russia itself has a beginning, a middle, and a fairly messy end. And the beginning, which is sort of where the book kicks off, the beginning is in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, all the dates here, you know, the beginning maybe was in 1987 with a joint venture law, but broadly speaking, Western companies stampeded into Russia following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia was an emerging market. This was a time of globalization, and companies wanted a piece of the action in the new Russia. There's a middle to this story, probably in the 2000s, before 2008, when the price of oil was high. Russia is a major oil exporter, and Russia and Moscow became an incredibly wealthy country with an extremely wealthy capital. And companies were just minting it. I mean, it was sort of plant any seed and it would grow. And then the end comes with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine and the stampede, pretty much, of international companies out of Russia, almost with the same velocity and almost with the same volume that they rushed in 1991. And so I thought, you know, here we have a narrative arc. We have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think that's what makes a story.
Okay. You write time and again that the business community was surprised by the level of instability and violence in Russia. And you kept saying nobody predicted this, whether it was the invasion of Ukraine, the subsequent expulsion of most Western companies from Russia. Talk to me a little bit about what signs and signals were being missed in the decisions that these companies were making.
Yeah, thanks for that. So this is where you have to be a little bit careful about how you write the book. There were, you know, the book is based on more than 70 interviews with executives and politicians and analysts and academics, all of whom had, you know, time and experience on the ground in Russia. And the extent to which people can say that they identified the signs and the signals from the very beginning, that this is where we were going to be in, you know, 2025, let alone 2022, the number of people who could do that is actually quite small. And I think here's what got in the way. First of all, business was good. And what people, what executives in Russia are looking at primarily is they're looking at the annual figures. So they're looking at the quarterly figures. They're looking at the monthly figures. And in Russia, for a very long time, those figures were very good. So all the lights were green and business was doing well. And looking at politics, looking at Putin, looking at geopolitics was important, but not as important as business performance. And so some of the things that were happening along the way, I think, were either overlooked or minimized. And here's a very quick example. So in 2003, Putin nationalized one of Russia's biggest oil companies. It was called Yukos. And the CEO of Yukos, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was arrested and put in prison for 10 years. And this was extremely distressing to the Western business community. They thought, wow, you know, is Putin going to nationalize my company next? What does this mean for me? What does this mean for the future of business in Russia? And then, you know, after a while, Cheryl, business just kind of recalculated and moved on. This was a warning signal that everyone sort of initially, I think, took to heart, but then sort of adjusted and said, okay, well, you know, this is what happens. We got to get on with business. So, you know, there were moments like this over and over again that some people noticed and said a green light is turning to an amber light. And other people said, you know, look, as long as business is okay, none of this is really important to me.
I think what you're pointing out is short-termism. Right. They're looking at the recent quarter. They're looking at what's going on in this small window of the world, and they're sort of missing out on the bigger context, or also a bit of a narrative bias in addition to a recency bias, which is, you know, that, you know, our narrative is good and that other thing is that other thing. And maybe it's doesn't really fit into the construct of what we have. So that leads me to my next question, that this is, you know, very much a book about making decisions amid uncertainty and high risk. And what did you learn about making high stakes decisions? And, you know, how can you extrapolate from that to how that piece of wisdom can be used outside of learning what you wrote about in the book?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in my work as a consultant and in the work I did reporting the book, I think one thing emerged as probably the most important thing about making decisions and problem solving. And that is, in Russia, which was a high-risk environment and always has been, the companies that were able to make decisions, I'm going to use this word carefully, but the companies that were able to solve problems and make decisions unanimously were the companies that did the best in Russia. And what I mean...
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, what I mean by unanimously is the companies that used a holistic approach to problem solving and to decision making were the ones that worked the best. For example, in a lot of companies in Russia, we saw internal conflict between, let's say, the business development function and the legal and compliance and the risk functions. And so the business development function at these Russia meetings would say, Russia's a great market, go, 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 what are you worried about? And the business development people are also incentivized to do deals. The legal department, the compliance department, the risk department was saying, hang on a minute here. What are you talking about, you know, go, go, go in Russia? How about wait, wait, wait? And you had inside organizations that sort of push me, pull you kind of decision-making process. And companies that had those sorts of internal conflicts never fully got behind their mission in Russia. There were a couple of other ways that companies fractured when it came to Russia. There were different decision-making processes and problem-solving processes among the expats and among Russian employees. There were different processes in the Moscow office and in headquarters. And sometimes all of those differences were very, very difficult to bridge. And so what I learned is that companies that brought risk, the risk function and the business function together, that trusted their Russian employees and took their viewpoints on board, and that were also able to kind of close the gap between headquarters and Moscow, those companies did extremely well in Russia, and everybody else stumbled a bit.
Interesting. So let me just ask you then, what did you learn also? You're pointing out a bit of lack of trust. So what did you learn about making decisions when there is a lack of trust?
Yeah, I mean, I think that decisions that are made in the absence of trust ultimately are extremely unstable decisions. They're not durable decisions because the moment after they're made, people start to unpick them. Companies lack conviction. They can't get behind them. And then also, by the way, you know, companies where there is a lack of trust internally External business partners pick up on this. External business partners can sense when their business partners are conflicted inside. And if that conflict is based on a lack of trust, ultimately, it's very difficult to hide. And again, I'll come back to sort of how reluctant Western managers were to trust their Russian employees. And, you know, in the 1990s, that was extremely pronounced. In the 2000s, that got a little bit better. And the book is full of examples and people basically saying, our company started to thrive in Russia when we started to trust our Russian managers.
Talk about that. What was it that they didn't trust from the Russian managers? What was sort of the misunderstanding between the people operating in Russia and the people operating, you know, from wherever their respective home bases are?
You know, it was really from the sublime to the ridiculous. I mean, it was everything from, you know, very strictly speaking, language problems, very strictly speaking, sort of cultural problems. And then beyond that, though, it was sort of, you know, let's say an expat would say, I've worked at this company for 30 years, but we've only been in Russia for 10 years. So what could our Russian employees possibly know about this company or about our products or about our market? What could they possibly know better than me? And so it was a question about experience. It was a problem about business culture. The Russian business environment is extremely opaque. You know, in the best of all circumstances, the Western business environment is built on transparency. And so it was just trying to reconcile these differences. And, you know, there was a time, let's say starting in the 2000s, when, you know, sort of smart Russian, you know, businessmen and businesswomen were going to Harvard and Wharton and Stanford and you know, going to getting business degrees in London and Paris, and coming back to Moscow with MBAs and probably beginning to know more than their expat managers. And so once there was a little bit of an equalization in business knowledge and business culture, you saw a certain amount of trust begin to grow.
Do you think that this is unique to doing business in Russia as opposed to doing business in another emerging market?
No. And, you know, thank you for pointing that out, because it happens in China, it happens in India, it happens in Brazil, to varying degrees. And, you know, one of the other problems with trust, Cheryl, is that the way large international companies are traditionally run with their international operations is that, you know, somebody gets posted to Moscow or Shanghai or, you know, Delhi, you know, they get posted for 2 or 3 years. And then their posting is over and they get moved on. Yes. And what happens is, you know, both the expat staff and the Russian staff or the Chinese staff or the Indian staff, they have to start from scratch every 2 to 3 years. That's enormously frustrating to business. It impacts trust, because if you spent 2 to 3 years building trust with your local CEO and then he or she has moved on to Dubai, then all of that work, you know, is essentially spent. And you start from scratch with a new person who's unpacking their moving boxes, you know, the next week. So it's not unique just to Russia.
Yeah. With so many risk factors, though, present, what did you learn about, is there a part of a decision that should have the greatest focus when you're operating in such an uncertain environment like this?
That's a tricky one. Can I give lots of different answers on that one?
Okay.
You know, what I learned, you know, in my work and in the book is that, you know, decision making and what's the most critical part of a decision or solving a problem, it kind of varies. And forgive me for this, but it varies. It varies by company. It varies by sector. It varies by nationality. You know, certain companies are on alert to certain factors because of the regulatory environment in their home jurisdiction. So for American companies, for example, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was one of the most important things that they thought about in Russia. because it has traditionally, until very, very recently, it has traditionally been fairly rigorously enforced over recent years. For some companies, it was security factors. For some, it was reputational factors. For others, it was financial or legal or operational. Here's the thing, Cheryl. I think that if a company can't decide what the most important factor is for them, they're doomed. Because you will have people spending different amounts of energy on different elements and in different directions. And sometimes that's good. That's what a lawyer is supposed to look at, legal things. You know, a chief operating officer is supposed to look at operational things, and that's great. That's why we all have different jobs inside of companies. But if we can't all come together and decide this is our biggest problem, this is where everyone's energy should be focused, you know, and then in Russia or in any tricky emerging market or even in any tricky market period, you know, companies struggle.
Okay. What do you think was the calculation that companies were making about getting into or getting out of Russia?
Right. So the decision to go into Russia in 1991 came against the backdrop of two important shifts. The first one was globalization. And that is that companies began to do business in places that were once considered, you know, too distant, too risky, too opaque, too dangerous to do business in. But globalization was changing that. The other thing is that we had a really interesting sort of rebranding going on as part of globalization. And that is that countries that we used to refer to as third world countries, you know, which wasn't a very nice thing to say about a country, those countries got rebranded under globalization as emerging markets.
That was an interesting discussion.
Right. And emerging markets, you know, first of all, sounds very polite. And secondly, sounds investable. You know, a third world country doesn't sound like a place where you want to spend money. An emerging market sounds like a great place to spend money. And Russia became an emerging market. And politicians all around the world, by the way, were saying, hey, the Soviet Union is history. We've got this new Russia. Go invest. And the more you do business with Russia, the greater the likelihood that Russia will not be an enemy like the Soviet Union was. So that's sort of what was going on on the way in. On the way out, it was for a while genuinely panic stations. I mean, the number of companies that sort of had a crisis management plan for what happened with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, you know, you could count them essentially on the fingers of one hand. For everybody else, the drivers to leave Russia were as varied as you can imagine. You know, once sanctions came in, a number of companies absolutely had to go because it became illegal to do business in Russia, period. You know, got to go. Then there were companies where their stakeholders sort of said, look, you know, Russia's an aggressor nation. You know, we don't really like the idea of doing business in a country like that. Employees, customers, shareholders were saying, this isn't a good look. We need to get out, even if the company wasn't under sanctions. And then, you know, finally, there were, well, you know, among other things, but also in, you know, in sort of descending order of importance, there were some pressure groups that were naming and shaming companies doing business in Russia and were threatening boycotts. And so for companies that were sort of B2C companies and were concerned about their reputation on the market and their brand, they sort of either quickly or more reluctantly came to the decision that it was time to pack up and leave. What I will say lastly, though, Cheryl, on this is that, you know, there were plenty of companies that stayed, including, you know, consumer brands that, you know, are household names.
And you gave a great anecdote about this. Why don't you share that about the candy company?
Right. Well, I mean, there's, you know, for example, you know, legally speaking, you cannot buy Coca-Cola in Russia. But you can buy an Oreo cookie in Russia perfectly legally if you want. I mean, you will find Coke on the shelves in Russia, but it's basically brought in from other countries. But there was an anecdote from the CEO of Mondelez, which is a company that owns a lot of very popular sort of confectionery brands. And the CEO of Mondelez told the Financial Times, and I'm going to paraphrase here just to be careful, but he said, our shareholders don't give a damn if we're doing business in Russia. You know, Mondelez's business in Russia was small compared to the rest of its global revenue. And a lot of the companies that stayed in Russia stayed because they made an economic, a sort of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, yes, it's damaging to your reputation, but it was expensive to leave. And, you know, also, by the way, I mean, you know, President Putin made it extremely difficult and extremely painful for companies to leave Russia after a while. And so maybe the size of the business wasn't worth all the hassle. I think what this leads to, Cheryl, is, you know, an interesting question that we'll never answer. But that is, you know, who looks smart now, the companies that left Russia or the companies that stayed?
Interesting. Are there any decisions that you would redo or undo? Which would they be? And how would you change these decisions about doing business and understanding the business culture in Russia?
Yeah. Here's what I would, you know, I've been on book tour for the past few weeks and get a lot of questions from the audience on these events. And people say, you know, what would you tell a company if it was going into Russia now? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, or what would you do differently if you knew now what you knew then? Or wait, did I get that right? If you knew then what you know now. So, Cheryl, I think what this boils down to is challenging our assumptions. And I think this is a really important part of decision-making and problem-solving anywhere and everywhere. And what I found over and over again is that companies didn't challenge the assumptions that they were making about Russia. They didn't challenge them vigorously enough, and they didn't challenge them often enough. And so what I would do differently, including, you know, maybe in some of my own personal circumstances, is, you know, I would make sure that companies, you know, didn't ignore amber lights and didn't ignore red lights, certainly, but that all of the assumptions that we all made about doing business in Russia, I would have just really put them under a microscope a lot more regularly.
What is that? I think it's an excellent point. And we naturally operate through our assumptions. So what does that mean in practice? Can you give me like one example?
Yeah.
You know, so that somebody thinking about this calculation has a better understanding of what the recommendation is.
That's right. I mean, at the very beginning, we talked about narratives. And one of the narratives about Russia was that it was a narrative very similar to one that we were familiar with and comfortable about in the West. And one of the earliest assumptions that we made about Russia was that its trajectory would be towards a liberal democracy and a market economy. And, you know, this is what everybody was thinking at the time anyway, that this was the end of history argument, that all societies and all sort of states, if you will, were trending towards liberal democracy and open markets, and that the two absolutely it coexisted and had to coexist. And so, you know, that led us to make a bunch of assumptions about where Russia was going. And, you know, there was a German expression for this. You know, there's always a German word for everything. And there was a German expression for this process that Angela Merkel used regularly, and she called it Wandel durch Handel, which essentially means change through business. And one of our assumptions was that by doing business in Russia, we could change the country. And, you know, to a certain degree, that happened. Russia did open up. Russia's people opened up. Some of Russia's companies opened up. But I think it had a limit. I think it had a ceiling. And I don't think we changed Russia politically. I don't think we did that much to change Russia economically in the long run, again, using a little bit of hindsight. And, you know, we know that now also about China. And we know that also about a lot of other, you know, emerging markets and mature markets, that doing business, you know, eating a Big Mac doesn't make you a Democrat, you know, a little D Democrat. And we kind of thought that it would.
Thank you. So you've been so generous with your time. What haven't I asked you that I should have asked? And then please share where people can learn more about you and where they can go ahead and buy your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I mean, what haven't you asked me? So here's a question that people do ask a lot is, you know, when or will I ever go back to Russia? I mean, I lived there full time for a while. I commuted for a while. I went back and forth on business trips a lot. My first trip to Russia was in 1983. So it was actually a trip to the Soviet Union. My last trip to Russia was in 2019. And then we had the pandemic and lockdown, and then my visa expired, and then we had the war. You know, so a lot of people ask, you know, whether or when I'll go back to Russia. And it's a really bittersweet kind of question, because some of the best times of my life as a professional and also personally were in Moscow. It's a dynamic, engaging, thrilling, exciting, high-energy city. I still have a lot of friends there. Thankfully, a lot of my friends left Moscow and they moved to London or Dubai or Berlin or Spain, so I can visit them a little bit more easily. But there's still plenty of people that I would love to see. And I think I would love to go back. I think there'd have to be a lot of changes. The one reason why I don't want to go back right now is that I don't want to have to go there and pretend nothing's happening. And I think that that's a coping mechanism that a lot of people in Russia are using right now. And that makes me very uncomfortable. Cheryl, I mean, first of all, you've been very generous with your time and hugely generous with inviting me onto the podcast. I'm going to take advantage of your generosity by saying, if you want to know more about me, if you want to know more about the book, I have a website. And the website is very simply charleshecker.com. The book is called Zero Sum, The Arc of International Business in Russia. It's in bookstores all over the place. And it's on websites named after very large South American rivers. And so you can really find it in stores and online pretty much everywhere you want to go.
Charles, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. It is a fascinating story, well told. Thank you so much for being on the Problem Solve podcast. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining in. We look forward to being with you again next month. Thank you.
Cheryl, thank you. The pleasure's been all mine.